Good afternoon, it's Mountain Edition. I'm Patrick Fort.
And I'm Marcy Krivenin. The Pitkin County Commissioners visit a marijuana grow facility and do a little sniffing around.
A construction site in the heart of Aspen is nearing completion.
It's pretty much on schedule, but it's close. To get all this done in one construction season is pretty tough.
Get your taste buds ready. A local chef is bringing an affordable food festival to Carbondale.
Everything's not processed. Everything's right in our valley. Everything grows in our valley. No one participating is from Denver. They're all within this area.
A decades-old silver mine left behind toxic tailings. The Forest Service is cleaning them up.
Colorado's Wildlife Service is looking to add archery to PE classes.
Luckily, this meets standards for PE, so PE teachers can easily incorporate it.
And we talked to forecasters about how a strong El Nino will impact skiing and riding this season.
That's all coming up on Mountain Edition.
1 week ahead of a decision on whether to renew a license for a marijuana grow operation, the Pitkin County Commissioners visited High Valley Farms. The business has elicited complaints from neighbors over a skunky smell. The elected officials looked over new technology that's meant to mitigate the odor.
Four of the five elected leaders arrived at the 25,000-square-foot greenhouse early Wednesday. It's near downtown Basalt, across Highway 82 from the Holland Hills neighborhood.
We're doing a site visit of High Valley Farms today.
Commissioner Patty Clapper.
Just to see the operation, see how the greenhouses are set up, and get some information about the existing vent systems and what's being proposed.
The elected board requested the visit after hearing from neighbors who say the smell is impacting their quality of life and property values. Once inside, the commissioners show their IDs and pull on surgical booties. The facility consists of four greenhouses. It supplies marijuana to a retail store in Aspen. Greenhouse officials point out two failed attempts to mitigate smell, a wet mist system and a dry vapor system. Both have been abandoned. Now growers will space out harvests and send the air in each greenhouse through a set of carbon filters. That's the sound of air escaping through the filters outdoors. The vented air doesn't smell like marijuana. Jordan Lewis is CEO of High Valley Farms.
The concept is very basic. It's a fan that pushes air through carbon filters. The scale and the application is what is so novel.
So far, one of four venting systems is complete. The others are under construction. Lewis says they will be up and running by the end of the month. He says the new system and the loss of marijuana production during its installation cost the business more than $1 million.
I certainly hope that the commissioners will recognize our efforts. Now we know that this system is in, and we know that it works, and we know the technology is proven, and so we're thrilled about that.
It's probably a little premature to determine whether they will be as effective as they're touted to be.
Commissioner George Newman was on the tour. He says the grow house is moving in the right direction, but it's difficult to determine total effectiveness this early in the process.
It's brand new, and only one of the greenhouses is in operation at this time with that new technology. Today, it's a little too early to determine if it will actually be effective when all greenhouses are in full production.
The commissioners are scheduled to decide Wednesday whether to renew High Valley Farms' license.
The Ruby Park remodel project has a deadline that's around the corner.
Aspen Public Radio's Allison Bechtesh met with City of Aspen Transportation Director John Kruger on site to hear about the latest project updates.
How does this compare size-wise and amenities-wise to what was here?
Well, size-wise, it's a little bigger. The restrooms are going to be a huge improvement. The old building is over 30 years old, and the restroom stuff was all residential grade, one commercial grade. There's all sorts of problems. There's no ventilation. The sewer line was crushed, so it would back up. It was just a mess. So these are going to be really nice. And we actually took the restrooms out of the waiting area and put them over here as a separate building. And that will enable the passenger waiting area to open it all up. And then the raft, the drivers, and all the folks here that used to work up in the attic in this little tiny space will now have an area where they can hang out. So it'll be a huge improvement amenity-wise. The whole pedestrian pad is going to be snow-melted. We had a lot of conflicts, the guys on little plows trying and people walking, and it was just skiers, and it was a mess. So we won't have to worry with that. So I think it'll be a huge improvement for everybody once we get it done. A lot of activity. It's a really tight schedule. We're trying to get functional before Thanksgiving, and it's a real race.
Is it right on track? I mean, was it always going to be tight, or is it tighter than imagined?
Well, it was always going to be tight. It's pretty much on schedule, but it's close. Depends on how the weather is going to go, but to get all this done in one construction season is pretty tough. It'll be operationally complete by Thanksgiving, but we'll still have to do some work. Probably the landscaping, maybe the green roof. Some of that stuff will have to wait till next spring. I want to show you the bioretention, which is kind of a different deal. Everything from the roof and the building and the bus drive-through area drains back into this bioretention area that gets planted with landscaping, and it will treat the water before it heads on down toward the river and the water treatment system.
The last building was 30 years old. Will this last for 30 years?
I hope so. We'll see.
That was City of Aspen Transportation Director John Krueger speaking with Aspen Public Radio's Allison Bektesh about the Ruby Park remodel project. For photos and an extended interview, visit aspenpublicradio.org.
State officials say a new bus connection to Denver is going well. Aspen Public Radio's Elise Thatcher has this update on the Bustang service.
The Colorado Department of Transportation rolled out the uniquely named service in July, offering one round trip from Glenwood Springs to Denver each weekday. Tickets are $28 one way. Here's CDOT spokesman Bob Wilson.
People took to the service rather quickly, and last count, we're averaging about 60 passengers a day.
That's out of a possible 100 customers. The rate of ridership is about the same for the Bustang lines on the Front Range. Wilson says that's a success so far, but CDOT expects ridership to keep growing. Summer is traditionally slow for public transportation, and it can take some months for potential customers to adjust to a new service. CDOT is analyzing whether to extend the Bustang line to Rifle or Grand Junction. The agency may add weekends or expand weekday options. The connection from Glenwood Springs has, so far, cost about $1.2 million. Elise Thatcher, Aspen Public Radio News.
You're listening to Mountain Edition from Aspen Public Radio News. I'm Marcy Grivenen. If you missed the first part of today's show, you can find a podcast on our website, aspenpublicradio.org. While the Aspen Food and Wine Classic might be the biggest food event of the summer, local chef Susie Jimenez is trying to create a smaller event designed to bring the community together. It's the start of a larger trend in Carbondale's capacity to hold big events.
Elotes are a popular Mexican street food, grilled corn covered in chili powder, lime, and cheese. If you're feeling really decadent, throw some mayonnaise or sour cream on there. Put it on a stick, you're good to go. Susie Jimenez is preparing some of the food she'll be making at her inaugural Taste of the Valley event in Carbondale.
Yeah. It's like the turkey leg.
Yeah, it is. But it just cracked me up because everyone looks so cute with their little corn on their skewer just like chowing down
right.
With crap all over their face. I'm like,
right.
Yeah.
Okay.
You can think of Taste of the Valley like a hyper-local food and wine classic like the one held in June. You can watch local chefs make things you can try at home. Susie says that she wants the festival to be as homegrown as possible.
Everything's not processed. Everything's right in our valley. Everything grows in our valley. No one participating is from Denver. They're all within this area. you probably go to the store and find most of their stuff there too.
Susie's festival is part of a larger trend going on in Carbondale. More and more events like Taste of the Valley are springing up, next to established ones like Mountain Fair. Andrea Stewart, executive director of the Carbondale Chamber of Commerce, says more events have strengthened the economic health of the organization.
Our Carbondale Chamber membership is up, which is great. We haven't seen the numbers. We're right now at 462 members. We haven't seen that since pre-recession, 2008, so that's really exciting.
In addition, more tax revenue, web traffic, and praise for Carbondale coming from places like 5280 Magazine and Men's Journal. Stewart says Carbondale is now establishing itself as its own brand, not just a town that people pass through on their way to ski or for a soak in the hot springs.
You know, why not come here and stay here and play here and, you know, take in all that we have to offer and kind of make those day trips out instead of in the past that, you know, reverse approach.
Local residents want to be a part of these events as well. Local businesses are a focal point in Taste of the Valley. Jimenez has enlisted nearly a dozen vendors who will gather in the 4th Street Plaza on Saturday in Carbondale. David Matthews is the head distiller at Woody Creek Distillers. They're one of the local producers that was invited to participate. And while, yeah, the ultimate goal is to grow their business, David says it's still important to remember your roots and make sure that the people back home like what you do.
Part of our goal is to spread our products as far and wide as possible, but that being said, being part of our local community is particularly important to us. You know, everyone who works here lives locally. All our potatoes, for example, are grown very, very locally within 2 miles of the distillery.
And that's why Susie picked the distillery to be part of the event.
I'm very passionate about living in this valley and food, and I just want something here, you know, and hopefully this will kick off. Hopefully in 20 years, I'll be like, oh, it's my 20th anniversary, Taste of the Valley. I hope. We'll see what happens, though.
Andrea Stewart from the Chamber says that these events provide a platform for building a social network in the communities around Carbondale. They help everyone involved.
These events just provide that platform of networking. They also, the majority of them, you know, have a purpose behind it besides just a large event. So whether it's giving back in, to the community or a fundraiser for a local event, you know, it really continues to give after that one day.
And Taste of the Valley is one of those events that's giving back. Proceeds for the event go to help a program Susie started that helps children learn how to cook with real food rather than bringing in processed snacks to school every day. Jimenez says that the event is something really close to her heart. She hopes that in a few years, she can be proud of what she's created. And to her, that all starts with a successful first Taste of the Valley.
You know, I'm hoping that this is going to be like sort of the platform for the rest of the years to come. But if I sell out, I know that I did a really good job.
The Arts and Culture Desk at Aspen Public Radio is funded by the Stefan Edlis and Gail Neeson Foundation with a mission to support the arts, community, and outreach.
After its main festival event in Carbondale in April, the Five Point Film Festival goes on tour. This weekend, it's returning for a special homecoming event.
The festival is focusing on expanding its local brand and bringing different outdoor films to the valley.
There are a lot of festivals that stuff their billing with outdoor-centric films. Mountain Film and the ubiquitous Banff Mountain Film Festival come to mind. There's a lot of crossover in those festivals. But Five Point Film, the 8-year-old group, is trying to make a name for itself, nationally and locally. It goes on tour throughout the year to places like New York and Salt Lake City. This weekend, organizers will be holding a special event for the hometown crowd, one that'll allow them to try to connect with their community, with s'mores and a community jam session. Sarah Wood, the executive director of the festival, says the organization tries to select films that mix the emotional with the outdoorsy. She says the films they pick are a little bit more about the human experience than the ones you might see at other festivals.
So the combination of that and the thoughtful nature of how we put our programming together in terms of the emotional response that we are seeking to invoke in the audience is different.
The short film Denali is an example of this. It's the classic story of a man and his dog and the bond shared between them. It's a simple film, but in just under 8 minutes, it manages to run the emotional gamut, weightless highs and soul-crushing lows.
I don't know what I would have done without Ben. I'm so glad his cancer went away. I'd be so scared right now if I was going through this without him.
Wood says the program for a local event is different than the one they show in April's main festival. This weekend's event as a whole is different, focused more on fostering relationships than making money. She thinks that the community here is all about being together.
As I've been traveling around the country and introducing Five Point to different communities, the level of commitment that the community has here in the Roaring Fork Valley to each other, it just isn't replicated anywhere else.
Nearly all of the program for the event will be short films, quick hits of adventure like the film called 55 Hours in Mexico. Three guys head south of the border for a weekend ski trip on Mount Orizaba, the third highest peak in North America behind Denali and Mount Logan. Casual.
We just fly from Denver to Veracruz, rent a car, drive from sea level up to 14,000 feet. Then we'd stay in this hut, wake up early in the morning, climb the volcano, ski off the summit, head back to the airport, and then fly right back to work for Monday.
With only a little bit of altitude sickness along the way. This is Mountain Edition on Aspen Public Radio. I'm Patrick Fort. To stay up to date with the news in the Roaring Fork Valley, follow us on social media. Like us on Facebook, find Aspen Pub Radio on Twitter, or follow us on Instagram. Aspen Public Radio, your news, your music, your station.
For years, the Forest Service has been working to keep mine tailings from an abandoned silver mine from getting into Castle Creek.
The long-defunct Hope Mine is tucked between the creek and Castle Creek Road. Work to return the area back to its natural state is now nearly complete.
Work began in 2009 to reclaim the steep hillside in the picturesque Castle Creek Valley. It's on Forest Service land, but I didn't visit the site until 2011.
Yeah, they're gone.
That's when Forest Service officials partnered with local nonprofit groups on an experiment. The idea was to use biochar and compost to revegetate the area and prevent toxic metals from leaching into Castle Creek. Biochar acts like a sponge for toxins. It's carbon-rich dehydrated wood that often comes from beetle kill trees.
This was an emergency project.
That's former district ranger for the White River National Forest, Scott Snelson, speaking in 2011.
With hope that we could hold the slope with this treatment as opposed to pulling, basically excavating out the contours. And if this doesn't turn out to stabilize the slope to satisfaction, that's likely what we'll end up doing.
The biochar was helpful, but just as Snelson predicted, more work was needed. Jamie Cundiff is Forest Programs Director for the Aspen Center for Environmental Studies.
The Forest Service decided that it didn't want to risk that whole hillside failing into Castle Creek. So they decided to further mechanically stabilize the hillside. So in a year's time, biochar wasn't enough to completely stabilize the hillside, but it was incredibly successful in revegetating the hillside.
ACES merged with the nonprofit For the Forest that partnered with the Forest Service in 2011 at the Hope Mine. Before work started, the two-acre area was littered with toxic mine tailings left over from unsuccessful mining activity that began around 1915 and lasted until the 1940s. In addition to the biochar application, the Forest Service did asbestos abatement, removed old structures and mine debris, and stabilized the stream bank. Olivia Garcia is the abandoned mines and lands coordinator for the White River National Forest. She says the agency collected seeds from the area as one of its final steps.
Those seeds were grown over the winter, so the work that we're going to be doing this year is to actually put some plants, some shrubs and forbs in the ground that will assist in further stability of the site.
The plants are scheduled to go in the ground later this month.
The goal with all the vegetation there, it keeps the erosion. So basically the potential problem that we had originally is no longer a concern, and it's going to blend in just like the rest of the forest now. It's to mimic the forest in its natural setting.
The Hope Mine may be nearly restored, but Garcia says there are many other abandoned mines on the White River National Forest that pose hazards.
With the Hope Mine, it was the mine waste. Some of the other abandoned mines that we have, they have open mine features, such as horizontal openings, or they have vertical openings, which are called mine shafts. They pose a physical hazard to our public. But then we also have some others, not really physical hazards, more of an environmental concern.
She says the hazards are addressed by priority, and the Forest Service heavily depends on partners like the state and the Environmental Protection Agency for help with mitigation.
Major support for Aspen Public Radio's environmental reporting comes from the John Denver Aspen Glow Fund at the Aspen Community Foundation, promoting responsible stewardship of the lands and wilderness of Aspen and the Roaring Fork Valley.
Now that the leaves are beginning to change, weather officials are releasing forecasts for the upcoming winter. The jury's out on whether the strong El Nino pattern that's expected will bring heavy snow or dry conditions.
I spoke with two forecasters about their predictions. First, Joel Gratz of Open Snow, a weather service for skiers and riders.
This winter is going to be characterized by a strong to very strong El Nino. That means that water temperatures in the Central Pacific Ocean, west of South America, are very warm, much warmer than normal. And even though this is very far away from the western U.S. and Colorado, this still has impacts. And with El Nino, there is a relatively predictable correlation between the warmth of the water in the Pacific Ocean and precipitation and temperature patterns in North America and the western U.S. During the winter. So when people talk about El Nino, why is that a big deal? Well, it gives us a little bit better chance of getting the long-range forecast right. And generally, the summary is that the southwestern U.S. Would probably see above-average precipitation and slightly below-average temperatures, and the northwestern and north-central United States, kind of the northern Rockies and up into the northwest, potentially could see below-average snowfall and precipitation and above-average temperatures. And if you're listening carefully, Colorado is right in between, right in between the north and right in between the south. So unfortunately, there is not a lot of predictability with El Nino in Colorado.
And it sounds like Colorado is sort of teetering between the good and the bad as far as a skier's perspective.
Potentially, kind of the core skiing in the central Rockies, northern Utah, and Colorado is somewhat indifferent to El Nino. We have higher confidence of above average precipitation in Arizona, Southern California, and New Mexico. But when it comes to Colorado, there's just not as clear of a signal.
Corey Gates with AspenWeather.net is more confident in good snowfall. His forecasts are specific to the Aspen area. He looked back on past El Nino years.
1982 and 83 was one super strong El Nino. And 1997-98 was the other, and this year is going to be the third. So super El Ninos do pretty well here in Aspen. In 82-83, in town, had 216 inches of snow. 216 inches of snow in town is a boatload. That's in the top five all time. 1997-98 had 188 inches of town. That's also a lot. So if you're talking 216 and 188 inches in town, back on the previous super El Ninos, those numbers translate to 350 to 400 inches at the ski resorts.
And so what is your conclusion?
I think the conclusion is good. There's two dangers we have this winter. The water off the west coast started getting really warm last year. And that's kind of a negative because you don't want the water really warm just off the west coast, 100 or 200 miles, because it tends to cause a ridge aloft stationary along the west coast. When you have ridges in the high levels of the atmosphere, it tends to be dry. I think we're going to be okay for the winter. Sure, we're going to have some dry spells. I don't think the dry spells are going to be super extended. So I think my snow forecast is going to be normal to 10% above normal snow. All that translates to is from about 315 inches to 360 inches at the ski resorts, which is actually a great season.
And how does that compare, say, to last season?
It's better than last season. In terms of last season, our snow amounts were 265 to 330.
Corey Gates is with AspenWeather.net.
Getting kids to play outside is a hot topic, and this also applies to youth living in the Roaring Fork Valley. Colorado's Wildlife Agency is working to add archery to the list of options for kids and their PE teachers. Aspen Public Radio's Elise Thatcher has more.
11 men and women are shooting arrows at a row of yellow, blue, and red targets. We're in a cavernous ice rink at the Glenwood Springs Community Center.
They're going through the 11 steps of archery, so this is the first opportunity that each of the teachers have to actually coach each other.
Kathleen Tadvik is overseeing today's class, which is put on by the Colorado Division of Parks and Wildlife.
All of them going through the 11 steps. The stance is particular. The way they actually put their arrow on the bow is very particular. The bow is always vertical. The arrow is always facing downrange. You're always shoulder to shoulder because each quiver is only an arrow length apart.
Some of these teachers turned students normally run physical education classes, or PE. Others coordinate summer camps. There's folks from as far away as Steamboat Springs and as close as Glenwood Springs. They're learning that running an archery class is regimented for maximum safety.
So when you hear five whistles, five or more whistles.
Whistles are the best way for teachers in training to instruct their future students.
That you're supposed to stop. If you have an arrow knocked, you're supposed to ease it down. Walk back, put the arrow in the quiver.
This is
back,
one of the increasingly common archery courses for PE and other teachers. The idea is to add to what physical activity kids can learn in school or in summer camps. Instructor Tadvik says, yes, the Hunger Games movies have inspired more women, in particular, to try archery.
Yeah, we've seen an influx of a lot of people wanting to try it, all because of Katniss.
Is there more interest from parents and kids, do you think?
Yeah, I think so. It's hard for the schools to incorporate a lot of this with all the curriculum that they have to do. I mean, there's so many standards, and now this week you've got to teach this in the curriculum, and it's week by week. It leaves a little room for this, but luckily this meets standards for PE, so PE teachers can easily incorporate it as long as they have the school's support, the principal's support.
That likely will include Donna White.
I think it's great. I think it's something that should be taught in PE.
And are you a PE teacher?
Yes, I am.
Where do you teach?
Olathe Middle High School.
I replaced a teacher who brought it into the school, and I wasn't certified, so I couldn't use the equipment. Now I can.
And she is psyched about being able to run this program with her students.
I just can't wait to shoot arrows with my kids.
Towards the end of this class, instructor Dick Severin explains what may end up being the most important part for kids taking archery in school, tallying up points and seeing who's the best shot. Severin helps with hunter education in Northwest Colorado with the Division of Parks and Wildlife.
So you just start counting. You always want to score your target before you pull any arrows. So we're going to look at this one. We've got the blue one. So he's in four. Here's another blue one in five. So that is what? We got 17. The only rule.
Then, with careful precision, these teachers remove their arrows from the targets, remembering to look away from the target to position their body for maximum pulling strength. Once this practice session is over, these educators file into an air-conditioned lobby to study. They've got a big test on all the rules and regulations they learned today before they can bring archery to their gyms, fields, or summer camps. Elise Thatcher, Aspen Public Radio News.
That's all for this week's Mountain Edition. Have a nice afternoon. I'm Patrick Fort.
And I'm Marcy Krivenin. To hear this show again or download a Mountain Edition podcast, head to our website, aspenpublicradio.org. Mountain Edition is a production of Aspen Public Radio News.